So tonight we're into George Whitefield, and we still are not up to the Great Awakening. We're not to, we do not get to the Great Awakening supposedly until 1739. So we get close to it, but we have to deal with these players that are in the background. We've already talked about Jonathan Edwards, and we've talked about Whitefield to some extent, and we have yet two more to go, and that's next week, which I think is really an interesting story about the Wesleys and how they were saved and the things that are not known about the Wesleys. They are credited with starting the Methodist Church, which probably is wrong. Whitefield probably, we'll talk about it a little bit today, Whitefield probably is the rightful progenitor of the Methodist Church. Now, Hoots would have been a Calvinistic Methodist Church rather than Arminian Methodist Church, which is what the Wesleys would have promoted. So, very interesting time of history. There's many questions that come up that I'd like to stop and talk to you about, and we don't have time to do that, but just one of the issues that I've thought about in every one of these personalities that we've visited so far with that we know about, they have this tremendous struggle in coming to faith. And this is going to be true of the Wesleys. It's true of Whitefield. It was true of Jonathan Edwards and anybody else we looked at. And I've wondered whether this was a little special for them. Did they struggle in a way that other people do? Or do I just forget that all people struggle with the same issues, but they don't get to write about it? You know, so I was thinking about, even if I thought about how I was saved, when I was saved, it wasn't a one day event, but I mean, it wasn't that I thought about it in one day and the next day was, you know, it took years. So I guess that's probably more normal, but when you read it and guys can express their feelings and describe the events surrounding it, it always seems like it's so drawn out and they're so struggling with this issue that I would say, well, just settle it, you know, and they don't. And we're going to find this true of the Wesleys as well. So that's next week, and I'm looking forward to doing that because it's a lot of, in some sense, difficulties come out of the Wesleys as they are added to what we would call the Great Awakening and the part that they played in it. So I want to talk about next week till next week. So we're still on George Whitefield. It's the third lesson of this winter. It's actually the 10th lesson in the series. And we are going to try to point at the spot. We're in 1735 to 1738, 37, 38. That's more or less where we spend our time. And next week we'll probably still not get into 39 because we need to deal with the Wesleys and the conversion. And I hope when I say the names, I always get the right ones because they start floating in my mind and the first one comes up is what I say. And sometimes it's not the right one. So if I make a mistake, you'll have to adjust. Remember last week we talked about the terms, the revivals or awakenings, and I wanted you to remember or wanted you to take away that revivals work for Israel because Israel can be a sleeping state that needs to be revived because they have national promises. We don't want to talk about the churches being revived because it doesn't have national promises. So we talk about the churches being awakening out of its death, out of a dead state. So even though we use them interchangeably, more accurately, revival would be for Israel, although we don't talk about that anymore because we're not really focused on Israel these days. There will be a revival someday, and the tribulation will bring them into the millennium. But the awakening in the church has gone on at different times, and we're looking at one that's in the 18th century, and there were others, and we get to the end of our study. I want to talk about the one that looked like probably was even in our time in the 70s, which really would have be considered a minor awakening. Last week, we looked at the early life of George Whitefield. We didn't see a promising life here, come from a broken home, and really nothing going for him in a sense, although he did come from a well-positioned family. His father died and his mother remarried, and that didn't work out very well. They didn't lose their property, but the property ended up going to other people's hands, so he actually didn't have the funds to go to college, and so he went as a slave, in a sense, to college. Remember how that was? And in the process of this whole issue, he becomes part of the Holy Club, and the Holy Club was an idea of that would be to earn your salvation, to seek salvation, and it wasn't in the Holy Club that he was saved, but it was saved. He was saved in a long, extended struggle, and he came to faith at, I think about 1735 at age 20. And I asked the question, why is all this struggle going on? Was it unique for them, or does this go on in everyone's life? And probably goes on in everyone's life, like I say, but I'm not sure we all write about it. If we wrote about it, you probably would have to write something that took a time, took a period of time over where you became aware of your need, and then you have to struggle with, do you really want to do this? Is this something you want to give your life to? Is this something that you want to give up the control of your life to somebody else? You know, trust, that's called the faith part. And these things are usually, these things are really wrestled with over, sometimes over a period of years, as it was with Whitfield. I remember the quality of life in England was really pathetic, and it was just going downhill. And this came out of the oppression of the Puritans in England. First of all, it seemed like it's almost a reflexive reaction. Once the release from the Puritans in 1660, the king was back on the throne. And now everybody thought, now we can do what we want to do. And finally we got what we want to do. We're really be happy. And that found itself its own slavery. And so with this destruction that was going on in English society, it was really tearing the country apart at its fabric. So crime was so rampant, but it was so severely punished that it became a non-deterrent. I'd never thought much about that, but you punish crime so severely that it doesn't help to stop the crime, because you're going to be dead, you're going to be arrested whether you did a small thing or a big thing, or you're innocent because you're headed for the gallows all the way anyway, so you just well live the way you want to live and take your chances like everybody else. So this is how it was in England. The people were so hardened to punishment that they didn't have the punishment actually act as a deterrent, which it should. So there's excessive hangings, and there was prison time for minor offenses, even for unthought or, might say, unintended events you went to jail for. So not a good time at all for England, and it really came out of the idea of that they were now released from the Puritans who had controlled them for basically 100 years. Now, England is spiritually lost in the mid-17th century when Whitfield begins to preach to the nation. And here we have a cartoon showing the call to return to righteousness is in the midst of the punishment of a crime, hanging. Now, this is probably not a very realistic picture, although no doubt that he could have preached here. But to see people being hung and the man preaching at the same time would indicate there's something wrong with this culture, that the culture needs to wake up to the preaching, and that should minimize the hanging. So the land needed the gospel, and we know that the gospel changes lives. I'm not sure they understood that at that time. So it is this stage that George Whitfield is thrust in 1736. There was no mastermind on earth directing a career, no hired revival planner. Even Whitfield himself could not have ever expected to see what happened in his life. He could never imagine or plan the path that was laid out for him. And of course, you know, this was laid out to him by the Lord. And the world still marvels at his command over the crowds that moved so many thousands to salvation, and likely more than thousands to be confirmed in their unbelief. So we don't want to think that everybody got saved, but it was certainly drew a line in the sand that people could understand. So today we'll trace Whitfield's age 22 when he's in 1736. So when you pick up Whitfield, there is already in Savannah, Georgia, a missionary outreach of about 1,000 people for a settlement, American settlement. It's at Savannah. And a ministry to the native Indians. As always, an interest of the Christians has been from the beginning to reach out to the natives that were here in America. As a new believer, Whitfield's duties at Gloucester, which is where his home was, are philanthropic. He's still on the same bent he was on before he was saved, does good works, which is fine. He served prisoners. He ministered to the poor. It was where he formed religious societies, and these societies would have functioned somewhat like we would see a paraministry work, you know, there, or maybe even a Bible study that's really not necessarily controlled by the church, but people get together in these societies and they get names by the streets they're on or whatever. So he forms these societies, and this is where the Methodist society that's going to stand or last really comes from. This is the one that did the first Methodist society with Wesley did not endure. But this one that came out of Whitfield himself is the one that endures and is the one that we know today as the Methodist Church. We trace back to it, although we have down the road, we have Aldersgate, and that's the place where John Wesley apparently was saved. We'll talk about it next week. So they would still probably claim the Wesleys rather than Whitfield. And there's probably a reason for that, because remember, there will be an argument between these positions. One is a Calvinistic position, one's an Arminian position, and a lot of other things go with the Arminian position. And the Methodist Church has generally been on this side, not on the Calvinistic side. So Whitfield was at Gloucester, his home, for 7 months. And this is really hard to keep track of where he always was, so I may make a mistake here or there. If I do, the Lord will forgive me. I hope you will. Do the best I can, because he moves around a lot, and so where he's preaching when, sometimes hard to figure. But I'm going to go with what I think is right. After Whitfield was at Gloucester for 7 months, the Church of England Bishop Martin Benson wanted to see him to encourage him to receive the holy ordinate orders. Now, he's been saved now, so in some sense it would make sense, although it's hard to know what Benson saw in him, because these men in the Holy Club were sort of special to Benson. He'll see him again later. And these are targeted to go into difficult places like Georgia. So he wants to encourage them to be ordained, but the ordination here now is to a deacon, not to a priest. They would use the word priest. So from Gloucester, he returned to Oxford, which is the school, and I've got the map up there. The word I was trying to remember the other day that I stuck on and was Wales. It's on the western side of England, so we're just below the Wales. We have Gloucester, we have Bristol, and we have Bath. Those are kind of the haunts where Whitfield was, and also John Wesley will be. And we have Oxford in the middle, and then to the right, you have London. So from Gloucester to Oxford, London, another 50 miles, and then from Gloucester to London, probably 100 miles. So it comes to get an idea how far that is, and they would have probably ridden horses and would have taken a couple of days to make that trip, maybe even on a horse, probably 3 days. Okay, so from Gloucester, he returned to Oxford. It was different now in Oxford than it was when John and Charles were there, because they had gone to Georgia about a year ago. During this time, Whitfield did personal work. He's not ordained yet, by the way. He's just thinking about it. During this time, Whitfield did personal work, explaining the Bible, exhorting in extempore, in manner, you know, sort of talking without notes. He was a student working toward a degree, which he fulfilled joyfully, an undergraduate degree, let's say, and then his ordination. His ordination would be that of the status of a deacon as part of the Church of England. Whitfield was not did not feel qualified for this. I guess that's the first impulse everybody has. But he stands for ordination, which permits him to serve the priestly functions. And he had concerns for money, and that was one of the things that held him up. I don't know how these people actually function, how they got their money. But he never did make for any appeals for money, and money came to him. And he took that as a sign that God really wanted him to be ordained, and it really had benefactors the rest of his life. And he did solicit some of it, of course, for his projects, but money never seemed to be an issue with Whitfield, so that probably was a load off his back. Now, I mentioned this because we've talked about other groups before, but Whitfield was in the beginning a churchman, and in the end remained so. Now, I'm talking about Church of England man. He was not a Puritan or a separatist or a Baptist, but he was a loyal evangelical in the Church of England, abiding by its rules, as best as he could, concerned when accused of breaking precedent. Now, this is a little bit not uncommon, but it is uncommon. Can you think of two men in our lifetime, I think they're both deceased now, that were evangelicals in the Church of England, that were writers? You're thinking of it, John Stott and G.I. Packer. So those two guys would have been in the Church of England. As far as I know, they died in the Church of England. You see, with all this other stuff going on, they still stayed in the Church of England. So there are evangelicals in the Church of England. So at this time, Whitfield remained or became, as a believer, an evangelical in the Church of England. So he headed for Gloucester to be ordained. And this is the church, apparently. It's an old church. It was ordained in 36. He began ministerial duties for prisoners, offering prayers at a service, christened an infant, performed a marriage. And the following Sunday, he preached his first sermon, 1736, as deacon. And I just noticed this church here. I had a little interest in architecture. This Mary Decrypt Church in Gloucester. This church was built in the 12th century. That makes 1100. That's old. And retains some of its original Norman features. So I said, what are Norman features? And I should know that like the top of my head. So I looked them up. And what you see, if I have pointed out here, on the side door there, you have this arch with the lacework. That's a Norman feature. Another one would be the ribbed arch inside. I don't know whether this church has that. I didn't see it. Didn't have a picture of the inside. So it's interesting. This is a very old church, and it has still marks of it from the 11th century. Now, we think out here something 100 years old. We think it's an old, but that's one thing when you go to Europe and you come home and say, there's nothing old here. It's all, you know, really relatively new. So these have a lot of history. So he talks about his message. I trust I was enabled to speak with some degree of gospel authority. Some few balked, but most for the present seem struck. And I have since heard that a complaint has been made to the bishop that I drove 15 mad the first sermon. The worthy prelate, as I am informed, wished that madness might not be forgotten before the next Sunday. I think he means that it was probably good for those guys to go mad. I think that's what he means. Such was the effect of Whitfield's first sermon on his hearers. He was braced for this reality. He said, I shall tell them the truth, and if I do, I believe they will not like it. Sound like Gil talking, right? Or Jeremiah. After a few days, he mounts his horse, I guess, and he heads to Oxford to complete his training, going into his master's studies. He's first a saint and then a scholar. So returning to Oxford, he settles into his studies, earns his master's degree. He oversaw the Holy Club. You know, what the Wesleys are gone. I began to be more content with my present state of life and thoughts of abiding at the university at least for some years. So it's kind of likes him there. You know, that sort of is a place to go. And he did have some funding, so it wasn't an issue. But a call came from an old friend called Broughton, Mr. Broughton, who was the chaplain at the Tower of London. By the way, the Tower of London is the jail of London. That's where they behead people. So the ministry there was probably to prisoners. Okay, and that's something that Whitfield did, you know. This is something that you do, all right? So he was asked there earlier, and he either didn't go or couldn't go or whatever, but now he's been asked again. Again, thinks he couldn't go, but he does. He comes in to ask his place at the chapel. Now, this, remember, Whitfield is a very young person. He immediately feels the inadequacy and said, Lord, I can't do this. I think everyone that's ever been asked the first time to do something in ministry, that's the first reaction. Well, perhaps a typical student aspiration, he planned to have 150 sermons prepared before he started to preach. Really? I mean, what student doesn't think that was a freshman? When I leave here, I'm going to have all my sermons lined up, so the first year I'm all set to go. Well, that didn't happen either. Nevertheless, he did accept Broughton's invitation to serve the chapel in London, about 50 miles south of Oxford. Now, people who saw this youthful person on the way in this clerical garb explain, now there's a boy parson. You know, they noticed his youthfulness, very unusual. What is he, 22? Which reminded Whitfield of Paul's injunction, let no man despise thy youth. So Whitfield's tower ministry lasted 2 months. A number of men were drawn to hear his expositions on the new birth. Some of these were later followers of his ministry. When Broughton came, returned to the tower, Whitfield returned to Oxford, and had been there, like I say, 2 months. Now, I don't want to make a big deal of this, but the books that I'm reading, Dalimore's book, talks about the problem that Whitfield had with pride. Well, Whitfield, like any other gifted person, had to deal with the adulations accrued to him. It took years, but to his credit, he did recognize and acknowledge it. Now, you know, sometimes I always think everybody that's in the pulpit's got to have some kind of, what's the word, ego? That's not too good a word there. But self-confidence, you don't get up in front of people, a lot of people, 10,000 people, whatever, and preach if you have no confidence. You know, the voice might be very squirrely and really quiet. So when a person gets up and does this and you see what reaction you can bring, it's easy for there to be pride in the life. Whitfield had to deal with that, and he admitted it according to the text and did acknowledge it. All right, just to mention that. Well, we're back at Oxford, another Holy Club man induced Whitfield to undertake his ministry at Dummer in Hampshire. Now, I was wondering about that name. You know, sometimes these names follow people. You know, those people are from Dummer, so they're Dummer. I don't know whether that was where the name came from or not, but Dummer, Hampshire, I don't think I want to live there. But anyway, this what happened to be a poor, illiterate group. But it is here that he learned a valuable lesson. He said, "The profit I reaped here from conversing with the poor country people was unspeakable. I frequently learn as much by an afternoon's visit as a week's study." And I'm sure he doesn't compare a week's of Bible study with conversation, but in terms of life and how it's going to be, these people that live close to the earth can probably tell him a lot more about life than he can tell. So I think that's really what it's saying here. So this exposure and respect for the weak and poor no doubt propel Whitfield into the next phase of his ministry that will shape the rest of his life. If you look at this, as with every story, you know, every piece is put in place for its purpose. And you see it being built as we go along to the point where Whitfield will be this person that will move thousands and tens of thousands by his preaching. But it took a while for that to happen. So this decision that would change the rest of his life was to become a missionary to Georgia. Not a new idea for him on the spot, which I'll tell you. The Wesleys have been there for a year already. He was offered a promising opportunity to stay in London, chose rather the place of a poor American colony, an unknown place for his ministry, Savannah, Georgia. At that time was little more than a clearing in the woods, more like we'd expect in Amazonia. Dr. Burton, a professor at Oxford, a trustee for the Georgia colony, knew of the needed preacher who were made in a heroic mold. You can't go in there somebody that doesn't have any courage. So he decided that the zeal of the Holy Club man might well be expended here. He had influenced John and Charles Wesley and others to take that voyage in the summer of 1735. John Wesley and Whitfield shared correspondence while Whitfield was at the Tower ministering, so Whitfield was somewhat acquainted with the details in Georgia. It was not going to be an easy work. He understood that. Charles Wesley nearly died there. 7 months into Georgia, he quit and set out for home. So Charles comes home, leaves John there, and Whitfield is still in England, so he must have known that Charles came back and the difficulty he faced there. John Wesley had asked Whitfield to come help. So it had gone that far. So like I say, there wasn't some say it was almost like a on-the-spot decision, but all these things makes me think it wasn't on the spot. Now step back a little bit and just think about the culture. I am struck with the contrast in the spiritual culture from theirs to ours, where now everything in our culture is everything that's spiritual is irrelevant. If there's a word at all that describes people today, it's irrelevant. What's the other word I'm trying to think of here? It doesn't have any consequence. Whatever you think, it doesn't matter. You can think whatever you think. It doesn't have any end. So that's how it is. But not in this day. Well, as they saw it in the last lesson, the depravity of the English 18th century society followed the departure of the Puritan conscience, they said, but did it? Because in the heart was the ever-present question of their own eternal damnation. This is the difference. It was an open and freely discussed topic. If you go out and have a coffee, this is what discussed. You know, how do you get to heaven or how do you escape hell, however you want to put it. Now, they had an accepted solution for this was just to increase your efforts to work to earn the merit. So that's a system, but you never know for sure whether that's actually enough, right? So you do more and you do more and you do more and you do more. For example, the Wesleys went to Georgia. Remember, it's a four-month voyage over treacherous seas. And every time I read about these ocean crossings, they run into a storm. And the storm takes everything off the deck and you know, soaks everything, and you're just barely going to survive. It seems every crossing is like that. And many of those ships never made it. So when you're going to go to America, it's a four-month voyage. Can you imagine? You start now, you wouldn't get there till June, whatever that would be. And you're not doing this on the beach. You're doing this on a rocking ship, you know, where there's a limited amount of food, limited amount of water, and a lot of sickness because it's confined. So we have examples. Went to Georgia, four-month voyage over treacherous seas to, why? Add to the possibility of saving their souls, in their own words. So that's why I say this is so different than what we find today. No one's doing anything that, from what we can see, to save their own souls unless they show up at a place like this or somebody shares the gospel with them. But it's not a conscious thing that people think about on a daily basis, at least not in the open. But our culture has simply made the subject not worthy of discussion. An embarrassment if anybody broaches the subject. When was the last time you heard anybody express a concern for the souls or advocate a work system? You know, I'm going to go to heaven because I'm doing these things. Let me just come out and say that. I'm going to go to Georgia so that I make sure of saving my soul. I mean, no one talks that way anymore. Maybe that's good. I don't know, because it's wrong thinking. But there was a change coming in England. At the Tower and at Gloucester, Whitfield taught the new birth. So back to Whitfield's plan to go to Georgia. It was his intention to go immediately. He went to Bristol to say goodbye in a sermon. And the people asked him to preach every day for a week. The churches became crowded and many were turned away for lack of room. Offers were made for him to come to Bristol, you know, like 20 miles away. After 4 weeks of this ministry, he moves to London to meet with Colonel Oglethorpe, who was the governor of Georgia. He happened to be in England at that time, going to return. Whitfield's intent was to sail with the governor, but the ship was not ready to depart for some months. In the meantime, Whitfield returns to preach at Stone House at Gloucester's home, and there he preached on Romans 8:30, and we know the text, and these whom he predestined, he also called, and these whom he called, he also justified, and these whom he justified, he also glorified. The very, very Calvinistic sovereignty of God in election passage. So we see that his theology being developed along Calvinistic lines, but waiting for Oglethorpe, the preacher again at Bristol, says, "On the Lord's Day, I preached four times to a large and affected audiences, walking perhaps 12 miles and going from one church to another. The sight of the congregation was awful." That's not a way we use the word. One might, as it were, walk on the heads of people. They were all attention and heard like people hearing for eternity, listening for eternity. So he continues, "I now preached regularly 9 times a week. On Sunday mornings, long before day, you might see streets filled with people going to church in the dark, with their lanterns in their hands, and to hear conversations about things of God. Other churches near at hand would be filled, even those that he wasn't preaching at, with persons who could not come where I was preaching, and those who did come were deeply affected that they were like persons mourning for a firstborn child." Well, after 4 weeks, he returns to London to preach. And when he preaches there, 9 of sermons have been published, and I think they're still available. You can read them. Sometimes these sermons are not easy to read. They're not like we preach at all. So 9 of these sermons were published and likely multiplied the range of his influence. Here, his preaching attracted the folks of rank, such as Lady Huntington. I don't know who these people are, Lady Anne Franklin and Duchess Marlborough, wife of England's great warrior, the Duke of Marlborough, a famous forebear of Sir Winston Churchill. Remember, God does not have grandchildren. The Methodism of the Holy Club died away with the departure of the Wesleys, but now Whitfield refers to himself as a Methodist. This use of the name did not die away and became the beginning of the legacy of Calvinistic Methodism. At this point, he has the blessing of the church of England. Whitfield encouraged people to attend the religious societies and the church services to receive the sacraments in their parish ministries. So he's a churchman, as I said. Well, Whitfield's waiting ministry, as he waits to sail, lasted 4 months. In 1737 was ending. He could not wait any longer for the governor to sail. So with groans and sighs, he finally said, brethren, farewell. So on December 30, 37, he left London, went to Dart, which is a coast, which is a harbor, and left there in 1738, where he had boarded the Whittaker. Now, it's interesting to me. We have the Whitfield on the White Taker. Got it? I thought that was funny. So we prayed. Good prayer. "God, give me a deep humility, a well-guided zeal, a burning love, and a single eye, and then let the men or devils do their worst." I'll recap a little bit. We have the reborn again, Whitfield. He begins the ministry immediately, which is an interesting concept. It seems like when people are born again here, they have to have 10 years of experience before they can do anything. I don't know. But one thing that makes it different here, these guys all had a biblical understanding. Everybody did. That wasn't when they would talk about the Old Testament, they probably know better than we do. They're not saved, but they were taught the Bible. So when you get saved, all of a sudden the Bible is in your, you know, random access memory. It's there, and you, that stuff all of a sudden makes sense. And I don't know sure how he preached as much doctrinally as he preached more experientially, I'm just going to guess. So he could pretty well get up and preach about the new birth right away, and apparently that's what he did. And he was gifted, no doubt about it. So he's being prepared gradually but surely for an expansive evangelical preaching itinerant ministry. You notice he doesn't stay in one place. He's moving around all the time, talking to different groups. And so far, most of the time he's in churches, but there's a couple of times already he's been outside, forced to be outside. But in the end, he will preach outside because he's not able to preach in the churches anymore. So we see these little things go along that are preparing him for a later ministry. His gifts and the calling are proven in England, which he leaves with the Church of England's blessing, apparently. He has called England back to the gospel in the doctrine of the new birth and the so-called Calvinistic doctrines of God's absolute sovereignty in election. Now, approaching departure, he began to extempore prayer and preaching. He is not, I'll do this again, he's not a Puritan, he's not a separatist, he's not a conforming, nonconformist, he's not a Baptist, he's an evangelical in the English Church of England. He is aware, however, that the message will generate opposition from the establishment church leaders and the common folks. Perhaps we'd call him a reformer in the mold of Martin Luther, keeping some entrapments of Catholicism as brought to the Church of England by Elizabeth. They retained the poison pill, the infant baptism, the communion as a sacrament, priests, form worship, and a host of other things, sort of like the Church of England's Episcopal Church still has today. But he was in the church, preaching in the church. Now, the purpose of the trip was to assist the mission work in Savannah, Georgia. Strange to me. Why was there this need for a small group of settlers? Or was it just part of the Christian charity? There's a few people there, we got to go. In Whitfield, I don't know how Whitfield's mind works. And he was saved here, so he wasn't going to get saved like Wesley did. So why did he go? Well, maybe one of the reasons was a foot door evangelism to America. You know, America was just coming on strong. It wasn't a nation yet. The colonies were growing. And he had seen the Pietists in Germany plant these orphanages, and they became footholds to minister from. So maybe that was what is in his mind. But we think he's going to a smaller area rather than a bigger area, sort of going opposite his career. But now in the retrospect, we can see it. But when he did it, it seems so odd, so backwards. So in the months waiting, Whitfield began to collect money for the mission's work. And I started to figure out how much money this is that he's collecting. So this is the way you do it. $1 is worth $180 today. So if he collected £1, $180. So if he collected £160, he collected $33,000. So we're talking about a lot of money. That's in our money today. So we have, as an example, he bought a set of Matthew Henry's commentaries, which is interesting that he already had written it and they were already published. Matthew Henry's that old. I mean, his commentaries are that old. They would cost £16, but that would be $3,300 for a set of maybe 5-6 volumes. So I said, quit complaining about the cost of books. Remember, a book publishing was very, very labor-intensive, even though with printing press, they had all put the machines put this together, blah, blah, blah. All right, interesting. One more comment on Whitfield made by Charles Wesley. You know, Charles Wesley had come back before Whitfield left. John was still there. Charles had returned a few months earlier in 1737, said of Whitfield's preaching, he had heard, "The whole nation is an uproar, other comments, all London and the whole nation rings of the great things of God done by his ministry." So Whitfield leaves England not as a failure, but as a roaring success, which will set him up for his return at the end of 1738. He only stays in Georgia for 3 months. Okay, he makes this trip quite a few times. So in 1738, less than a year from now, he'll be back in late 1738. Well, Whitfield made extensive preparations for his trip, taking supplies and goods to Georgia, collection for the missions, helped fund the expenditures for the trip and supplies. He took five young men with him to help as teachers, housekeepers, and one personal assistant. And we have to wonder about the accounting, and we'll skip this a little bit because of the time. But, you know, as far as I know, there's never any scandal about how he handled the money or anything like that. So while the Whitaker carrying Whitfield to America was waiting to sail out of port deal, the Samuel sailing in was bringing John Wesley back from America. They were in the harbor together. So let's talk a little about the two Wesleys. John Wesley had gone to America for one purpose. My chief motive is the hope of saving my soul. Both had been there. Charles had returned after 4 months. Whitfield and Charles Wesley were in England together for sure. Not sure about their contact. Okay. Nothing that they were contact. But Whitfield, Charles Wesley knew about Whitfield's ministry. I just gave you the contact. He said they'd all in an uproar about him or about the messages. Now they, that is, had assumed that salvation would come by the holy club type, that is John and Charles, had assumed that salvation would come by the holy club type discipline. He hoped that they would be accomplished by enduring the privations in the new world. Now, having returned, he knew that he had to, not John, returned, he knew that he had had to be changed inwardly and confessed, this is what John says, what I have learned, why what I least of all suspected, that I who went to America to convert others was never myself converted to God. Now, when I've taught this years and years ago, I always thought that Wesley was saved on the way back on the boat. He's going to contact Moravians here, and that's not true. I mean, this is just probably a comment about his condition later on, okay? Now, he didn't write that when he was on the boat. So later on, he looked at this and said, he was really not converted. He went to convert somebody, but he understood at that point he himself was not converted. So Wesley's coming back unsaved, went unsaved, came home unsaved. We won't get saved till next week, 2018. Just a joke. Well, Wesley had sailed with the Moravians, now John Wesley, with the Moravians on his way home from Georgia. The Moravians were German people, a small party of whom had been on board the vessel, also from Georgia. And we're talking a little bit about Moravians tonight. We're going out of time here. When they, on the way home, encountered a violent storm. Again, every trip has a storm, it seemed like. A terrible screaming began among the English. But the German, the Moravians, people carried calmly sang a hymn of trust and praise. And Weston confessed that during the storm, I was afraid to die. It was during those days in Georgia that Wesley had associations with Moravians, I got to get that right name. They testified of certainty and salvation. Wesley realized that he was ignorant of that assurance. This was the first contact John had with evangelicals that had any lasting effect. As his brother Charles, John had little good to say about his experience in Georgia. And enter the stage left, a lady. The last negative was a love affair turned sour, resulting in a $200,000 defamation lawsuit. John could not make up his mind about marrying her. There was a name, but I didn't bring her. So she shortly married another man. Show you something. For that, Wesley foolishly barred her from communion, triggered a lawsuit by her new husband. Thus the defamation charge. Well, now there's a warrant out for his arrest. The only way Wesley could avoid arrest warrant was to flee Georgia to South Carolina, jump his ship, and head for home. And that's exactly what he did. So it wasn't good for him. He was in America only this one time, 1 year and 10 months. It is on this trip home that he becomes agitated for gaining salvation by faith and not by works. They had talked to the Moravians after the storm event. So we've got to know a little bit about the Moravians here. A little short explanation. We have two places we're going to do this. They began in what is now the Czech Republic before the German Reformation. We're talking about John Huss. John Huss was the first of the line of the nonconformists. They were in line with Wycliffe. Wycliffe had been earlier in England, and Martin Luther in Germany in his defense of the true faith in Christ alone for salvation. Huss was burned at the stake at Prague, and these convictions, for these convictions in 1415, before the Reformation. The Moravians formed in the 18th century their own congregation. They didn't do that at first. They didn't have congregations, but they do now. And both Whitfield and Wesley had contact with these people. The conversion of John Wesley, as we will see next week, is contributed to the Moravians, at least partly. Now, they are a pre-Reformation entity. At first, they did not form congregation in order to spread the gospel, like a parachurch group again. Perhaps they could see, it seemed like a parachurch group, like navigators. They were hesitant to formulate doctrinal positions in that Christ is a mystery, and any attempt would likely be misguided, so they didn't. Although they believed that salvation was possible only through Christ, they accepted the creeds of the early church. They were Trinitarians. They ordained those pastors to office as a church that would rule out lay ministers, it seems. They practiced sprinkling as infant baptism, but with the modern, later on, modification, it became a sign for the parents to promise to raise their children Moravian, which is sort of more what Lutherans do today, I think. The adults that had been baptized, even as infants, were allowed to participate in the communion service, which was offered a number of times a year. Interestingly, for a comment on a public current practice, it says that the youth and adults may be baptized currently at a time they make a profession of faith. It would seem that they have two baptisms, that one is for the infants as a promise for the parents, have nothing to do with the child, to raise a child, or Moravian, and the second is more in keeping with the scriptural requirements. Just notice that. Now, typical of the separating and persecuted groups, the Moravian people also sought refuge. They found it in the nearby estate of Count Nicholas Ludwig von Zinzendorf, as others had done in the 1700s. In fact, he was the place where a lot of them went. In 1727, these estates were large. They almost became like little counties. We had your own army and stuff. In 1727, various groups formed a unity pact among different believers and established a 24/7 prayer vigil lasting 100 years. This continues to be the uniqueness of their group, the ecumenical purposes, which today is still true. A topic says essential unity, inessential unity, and non-essential liberty in all things love. That's sort of their motto. Okay, an early missionary people, the Moravian Protestant Church, began sending out missionaries around the world. The Moravians first came to America at Georgia. Now, in the United States, Moravians were the first in Georgia. While that settlement was largely a failure, it was a critical contact for John Wesley on his way back to England. After the failed mission in Georgia, the Moravians Protestant Church set up missions in Pennsylvania. They established Bethlehem in 1741. Where it becomes the center of Moravian missionary work for the British colonies and the rest of North America. Their claim to fame is that John Wesley was converted by their witness, and I'd say partly true. Now, they divided the provinces. I'm just going to skip this because we're running out of time. There aren't any in Nebraska, Missouri, Kansas, some on the East Coast, some in one in Georgia, I think. As all groups, the Moravians drifted from their moorings. They were known as borderline mystics, were open to experience, did not set forth doctrines lest they err. But at the time of Wesley, they were evangelical, with a cast to direct revelation by experience, using the lot and the Bible as the roulette wheel, throw verses, whatever. We mentioned this because John Wesley was influenced and ill-advised or ill-served by this approach to his decision-making. We mentioned the shortcoming of Wesley, and there are more, only to be reminded that God never uses perfect people. At times, he surprises us. And when these servants of God do not rise to the standards of our, to the levels of our standard, that surprises us. Sadly, John Wesley will consider Whitfield a very real enemy eventually and attack him brutally and publicly. And it seems like it's a one-sided fight. Another of the character flaws of John Wesley was his need to be superior. Now, remember, Whitfield was 11 years younger. Whitfield was his junior by 11 years. While it did not start that way, we have a clue on an estrangement in the harbor at Deal we just talked about. As Whitfield and Wesley vessels lay in the harbor, Wesley learned of this young friend there, but made no effort to contact him. Remember, he was the one that got him to go there, encouraged him to go there. John encouraged George. Now, apparently due to a failure of John in Georgia, who knows his former appeal for Whitfield to join him, now looks embarrassing. So John thinks perhaps Whitfield ought to withdraw. Whitfield ought to withdraw to London, not go. So Wesley puts chance to work to determine a course of action. So he writes out messages on a piece of paper, different messages, and he selects one of these papers at random, and it said, let him return to London. With this clear direction, he sent word to Whitfield to give up the journey to America. Well, Whitfield doesn't believe it. Although Whitfield was amazed, he was undeterred from his plans. Trying to see John, Whitfield was informed that Wesley had left. So Whitfield followed with a letter to Wesley assuring him that the necessity for him to continue the plans to Georgia. There's no hint of animosity here towards and so forth. So that comes later. So now we're talking about Whitfield heading towards Savannah. Whitfield saved in 1734 at Easter time. Whitfield determines to go to Georgia 3 years later. Whitfield leaves Deal early 38. Takes 4 months, February, March, April, May. Whitfield will be in America for 3 months, then returns to England to raise money for the orphanages. So that's kind of the plan. And we have a drawing here and a building that apparently is still from that time that is extant. Now, the trip to Georgia via Gibraltar, think about where England is, and go down to Spain and then go across, you know, kind of circuitous. The trip to Georgia via Gibraltar lasted 4 months. The time was not wasted, as Whitfield had declared that he would not know anything about Jesus Christ. And a lot of time in the book spent about what he did on the boat. A lot of people apparently were saved on the boat, including some of the rough-hewn sailors and even the captain. So at first he was a target of the rough-hewn sailors, but after months at sea, they encountered life-threatening storms and illness that nearly took Whitfield's life and others. He said that he was not ripe for glory yet. You might want to use that sometime when you have a near-death experience. Not ripe for glory. Finally, he landed America with notes of praise. And he said, now, brethren, into God's hand I command your spirits to the people that he's leaving. I must be away to your new world. May God give you new hearts and enable you to put into practice what you have heard. As surely as he hath brought us to this haven, so surely after we have passed through the storms and tempests of this troublesome world, he will bring us to the haven of eternal rest. And thus, as he parted, no doubt many may have been truly born again to go into the new life in the new world. Others never to forget the terrible warnings and loving entreaties that heard from his lips. So 3 months in Georgia were full of positive ministry experiences, but when there were only 1,000 in the settlement and he had left 10,000 in England, it may seem a bit of a waste of talent. But Whitfield had a rich ministry among the people there. While the idea of an orphanage had been planted in his mind already in England, it was seeing the need firsthand that compelled him to return to England and raise funds. I said, where do these kids come from? Well, the answer is that the parents died. I mean, that's all you can say. A lot of mortality with these plantations or these early settlements. So these kids were left orphans, and apparently there must have been a lot of them. And if two parents die, you might have 6 kids. So, you know, it happens. So it is hard to see a purpose for this visit except to orient Whitfield to the future ministry in America. I'm saying this. It is a bit stressful to turn our focus back to England in absence of Whitfield for 11 months and note the growing influence of Wesley going unchecked. We now turn to one more event, the Moravians as background for the conversion of Wesley in England after returning from Georgia, still not saved, late 1738. We began with a list of some of the characteristics of the Bohemian movement. It was strongly evangelistically oriented, having missions based in West Indies, Greenland, India, South Africa, Guinea, Ceylon, Turkey, working among the Jews in the cities of Holland and Germany. Quite impressive. As the evangelical movement gained strength in England, the only viable co-religionists who were like-minded, that is, born again, were the Moravians, who mixed with all the other religious societies. Kind of how they did it anyway. So now we have the Fetter Lane Society. One of these groups gained status as influential persons, frequented, attended, like a parachurch or even a coffee house ministry. And it was this ministry that John and Charles Wesley at Fetter Lane became their primary association and became more and more a Moravian outpost that had received and recognized status for it by the help of Count Zinzendorf, who had permitted, as a permitted society within the Church of England. So Zinzendorf actually got this from the Church of England. So they're kind of official. And so that's where John and Charles Wesley are ministering, or they're identified with this group. Now, we are reminded that the Moravians had a low view of Scripture and a high view of experience. Not a good mix. Remember the lot that Wesley drew? He got that from the Moravians, how to make these decisions. Really quite an easy way of doing it. Of course, it's not very reliable. As a result, Fetterlane was characterized by extraordinary fervor. There was no clear doctrinal teaching to keep the members from accepting various questionable religious influences. Nothing would hold a line. Now, add to the society probably the French prophets, although not all the French prophets were this way, but just call them the prophets, who were following Whitfield's ministry, as Whitfield's ministry produced some ecstatic emotional events. And I'm going to save that whole subject to a later time, because I don't want to stop here and do it, because it's going to develop the emotional stuff in these awakenings. They produced some ecstatic emotional events. The prophets saw that these in Whitfield's following were ripe for their own harvest. What's new? Some of the prophets, Moravians and others, thought that these ecstasies were manifestations of God's work, thus supernatural and not to be opposed or even questioned. Well, both Wesleys came in contact with these two experience-oriented societies. John and Charles write about their contacts. Sorry about the next one. John noted that the prophets were mostly women. Charles noted that they learned what they learned about perfection from these had ecstatic experience. In other words, they were told from another world about this perfectionism, which, by the way, will follow Wesley the rest of his life. So far, there are no conversions of the Wesleys, remember. Such, then, were the developments that took place in England while Whitfield was overseas. His work continued, the societies prospered, and the clergy began to oppose. The Moravians, brought a spiritual warmth, can't deny that, but being biblically weak, introduced superstitious practices. The prophets interjected the element of fanaticism and posed a threat which was a pseudo-supernaturalism. It always contends for the earnest but unthinking Christian people. So there we are now to address the Wesleys in England when they get saved. So they're not saved yet, but you see they had all this ecstatic, experience-oriented things that the groups that they're hanging around with put a high stock in, have a low value of Scripture, low regard to Scripture. They have no doctrinal statements to guide them, so they're whatever comes along. And that's, interestingly enough, is how it seems like the ministry will continue. So these little experiences that people have do shape them in their later life.